One led to the disused packaging shed, which was empty, except for old heaps of dirty styrofoam meat trays and rolls of plastic wrap. The other door was locked.
"I got it," Ollie said,
and as he knelt in front of it, he pulled a very sweet set of professional lock picks from his thigh pocket. It was as good a set as I'd ever seen, and he handled them with practiced ease. It wasn't the sort of thing soldiers carry. I'd have to ask him about it later. There was a soft buzz in my ear, and I held up my hand for silence. There was some static on the line, but Grace Cortland's voice was clear and strong.
"Thermal scans show multiple tangos."
Tango, or T, was field code for terrorist.
"Count how many?"
"Clustered. Maybe 20, maybe 40.
"Say again."
She repeated it and asked me to confirm reception.
"Echo one, copy."
"Alpha on deck," she said. "Local law on standby."
"Copy that." "Orders?"
"Proceed with caution."
"Copy. Echo one out."
I called the men over and we crouched down, heads together.
"Thermal scans say that we have upward of 20 warm bodies in the building. No way to know how many walkers. Their heat signatures are too low."
I saw the news register on each man's face. Skip looked scared. Bunny looked mad. Top's eyes narrowed and Ollie's face turned to stone.
"Five men in, five men out," I reminded them.
They nodded, but I added,
"This isn't the OK Corral. We don't know for sure that everyone in here is a hostile. Check your targets, no accidents, and I don't want to hear about friendly fire."
"Hoo-ah,"
they said, but without much enthusiasm.
"Now, let's go kick some undead ass."
Chapter 41, Claymont, Delaware, Tuesday, June 30th, 6:23 p.m. Ollie finished picking the lock and Bunny teased the door open, wary for tripwires and alarms, but no bells rang and nothing blew up as the door swung inward on rusty hinges. There was no other sound except the distant hum of motors. I took point this time. My soaked sneakers wanted to squelch, so I placed my feet carefully, taking my time to stay silent. The hall was empty and long, filled with gray shadows and the ever-present mist. We hugged one wall and moved forward in line, staying low, watching front and back, checking every door we passed. When the corridor ended at an L junction, I paused and peered carefully around the edge, keeping my head well below the normal line of sight. I made a follow me sign and we turned left to follow the hall. We found one locked door, which Ollie opened without effort, but it was just a storeroom. I lingered for a moment in the doorway trying to estimate the probable enemy numbers based on the amount of stored goods. I noticed Top nearby doing the same thing. He gave me a raised eyebrows look. Either there were 20 really hungry terrorists in this place, or the count was closer to 40. Maybe twice that. We backed out and closed the door. The hall took on a curve, and we followed it for another 20 yards until we reached a set of those big vinyl double doors of the kind that flap open when you push a cart through them. We flanked the doors, staying low, and listened. It took a second to settle into the vibrational rhythm of the place, mentally filtering out the sounds of compressors and other ambient noises that you might expect in a dilapidated old building. Then we heard it. A low, inhuman moan. It suggested a dreadful hunger, and it was on the other side of the door. Skip shot a nervous glance at Top, who gave him a wink that was supposed to look casual and light, and didn't. I saw the looks on everyone's faces, and I made them meet my eyes. It would reinforce the orders I'd given them. Prisoners, if possible. Then there was a sound to our right, farther along the curving corridor, and as we looked, there was a dark movement, and then the weak overhead lights threw a shadow on the wall. A silhouette of a guard with a slung assault rifle. A guard, not a walker. Ollie was closest, so I gave him the nod, and he went down onto the floor like a snake and eased into a low shooting position. I saw the guard's booted foot round the corner first, and then his whole body, and then there was a pfft sound as Ollie squeezed off two silenced shots. The man's head snapped back and he sagged against the wall. Bunny ran past me and reached the guard before he had a chance to collapse onto the floor. Between Ollie's shot and Bunny's quick feet, the whole thing looked choreographed, practiced. In human terms, it was terrible. But in the way of warriors, it was beautiful. A demonstration of the soldier's art taken to its most polished level. The cop part of my mind noted that Ollie's handgun of choice was a silenced .22, an assassin's weapon. The low weight of the bullet made a dot of an entry wound, but didn't have the mass to exit the skull, so the bullet just bounced around and snapped off all the switches. Ollie had taken him in the head with both shots. Most shooters, even the very good ones, are not good enough to confidently try two in the head without a double tap to the body to stall movement, and he'd taken the shots from 30 feet. Ollie had brought his A-game with him. Back at the vinyl door, we set ourselves for our entry. Foggy mist curled out from under the door like the tentacles of some albino octopus. The smell was worse here. The sewers had been bad, but the stench here was of meat rotting on the living bone. A vital corruption I'd only smelled once before, when I killed Javad. The second time. We flanked the door and Top pulled out a little handheld dentist's mirror and angled it under the door, slowly turning it left and right. Inside there was a whole row of big blue cases. Not a surprise, but it didn't exactly make me want to do the Snoopy dance. From what I remembered of the building schematics, this had to be the main production floor, but the rows of cases blocked all but a narrow strip. And in the center of the row stood a guard. He had his back to us, and he was craning to look through a slender gap between two of the cases. We heard more of the moaning, and now we could orient sound with location. Something was happening on the far side of the cases, on the big production floor. The guard was eager to see it. So was I. I holstered my pistol and drew my knife. I held a finger to my lips, then touched my chest. The others nodded. Bunny and Top curled their fingers under the flaps of the door. At my nod, they pulled the flaps open as quickly as silence would allow, and I moved into the room fast and hard. I reached around and clamped my left palm over the guard's mouth and used my thumb and the edge of my index finger to pinch his nose shut. At the same time, I kicked him in the back of the knee with one foot, and as he suddenly fell back against me, I cut his throat from ear to ear, taking the carotids, the jugular, and the windpipe in one deep sweep. I pulled him back and pushed him into a forward crouch so that his nodding head would prevent the spray of arterial blood. He was dead before he knew he was in threat, and it hadn't made a sound. Bunny and Skip took the body and eased it down as I straightened. I wiped the blade and sheathed it, drew my pistol, and thumbed off the safety. There were four cases in the row, and they completely blocked the door and hid us from whoever else was in the room. I took the dentist's mirror from Top and checked around both ends of the row. On our right, I could see down a corridor, formed by a second row of cases that were lined up at a right angle to the first set, and a row of laboratory tables cluttered with equipment. There was one guard standing in the gap between the two sets of cases, and near him were six men in stained white lab coats. Everyone was looking through the gap into the center of the main room. I faded back and used the mirror to peer around the left end of our row. Two guards stood shoulder to shoulder about 20 feet away, also looking toward the center of the room. But this time I could see what they were looking at. What I saw froze the blood in my veins to black ice. The room was large, as big as a school auditorium, with a high ceiling set with grime-covered louvered windows. Against the far wall was a third row of blue cases, and against the left wall were more lab tables. Scattered throughout the room were at least a dozen armed guards, all of them with automatic weapons, and maybe four more men in lab coats. But in the far left corner was a big cage, made from industrial-grade chicken wire and steel pipes. 10 of the blue cases stood with their doors wide open, and three guards were using electric cattle prods to drive a snarling, staggering line of walkers toward the cage. The cage was packed, wall to wall, with children. Chapter 42, Claymont, Delaware, Tuesday, June 30th, 6:26 p.m. The children were huddled into a pack inside the cage, their eyes wide,
their mouths trembling. I could see some of them weeping, but they made no sound, though whether it was terror of the walkers or threats from the guards that stilled their tongues, I couldn't tell. I pulled back and handed the mirror to the others, making them each take a fast look. I mouthed the words, "We need prisoners," but I don't know if any of them were able to process the thought. Top, the only man among us who had kids of his own, had the most murderous expression I'd ever seen on a human face. I held up three fingers and everyone got set. Ollie and Skip on the left flank, Bunny and Top with me. I counted down fast. "Go," I snarled, and we rushed into the room. Chapter 43, Claymont, Delaware, Tuesday, June 30th, 6:27 p.m. Bunny opened up with the shotgun on the two closest guards, blasting them into red tangles of flailing limbs. Top shot two of the lab techs and then turned his fire on the cluster of guards. I could hear shots and screams as Ollie and Skip tore into the guards on the far side. I raced straight forward, gun up and out, and shot the guard standing by the door to the cage. It was a long shot. Bad aim could kill one of the kids, but I had no choice. The walkers were yards away. My shot took the guard in the mouth, and he rebounded off the chicken wire and fell, his fingers still curled around the latch. As he fell, the door swung open. The guards with the cattle prods turned toward us. Two of them tossed down their prods and fumbled for their guns. I shot one twice in the chest, but even as I was swinging my barrel toward the other, the nearest walker leaped at him and buried its teeth in his throat. They fell together in a thrashing heap. I shot the remaining guard, who was caught in a moment of bad choice, drop the prod and grab his gun, or fend off the walkers. My bullet knocked him into the arms of a walker. The creature, a middle-aged Asian man in a tracksuit, bore him down and began savaging him. I shot the walker in the back of the head. A man rushed at me from my right, and I turned to see that there had been at least eight more guards on the other side of the first row of blue cases. They opened up with AK-47s, and I had to dive for cover behind one of the lab tables. I dropped, rolled, and came up by the far corner and emptied my magazine into them, dropping two. As I ejected the mag and slapped another in, Top Sims caught them from an oblique angle, chopping down three of them with bursts from his MP5. Skip Tyler opened up from the other side, and the guards tried to fight their way out of a crossfire. Behind me, there was a huge shriek of noise, and I spun to see the children surge through the open doors of the cage. Three walkers lunged at them, and that fast I was up and running, shooting above the heads of the children, trying to make headshots while dodging incoming fire. The children were hysterical, and in their panic they flooded across the entire production floor. The gunfire from Echo Team faltered as the children surged around the lab techs and guards, trying to flee the walkers, looking for any way out and finding only guns and teeth and terror. One of the lab techs whipped back one flap of his white shirt jacket and pulled a Sig Sauer and shot a 10-year-old girl in the chest. "Fuck, prisoners," I heard someone snarl, and the tech died in a hail of bullets. The voice I'd heard had been my own. The bullets mine and Top's. A guard brought an Uzi up and tried to shoot me, even though there was a line of children between us. I shot him through the eye. "Run!" I yelled to the kids. "Go that way!" I pointed toward the door, even tried to shove some of the kids that way, but their terror was too deep, too complete. "Behind you!" I heard Bunny roar, and I crouched and spun to see a walker, a hulking brute in a football jersey, lunge at me, his mouth already smeared with blood. He was coming so fast that I knew that a headshot wouldn't stop him, so I drove into him with a sliding sidekick to the thigh that jerked him to a stop, and as I pivoted off the kick, I brought the gun up under his chin and blew off the top of his head. As he fell backward, another walker leaped over him. This one was a young woman in what had once been a very expensive tailored suit. I shot her in the throat, but the bullet tore only flesh and the slide locked back on my gun. There was no time to reload as she slammed into me, so I pivoted to let her mass whip around me and past me. Her fingers never managed to grab me, and she flew off and slid 10 feet along the floor. With a human being, the shock and impact of the fall would have given me a few seconds to reload, but the walker came right off the floor and dove at my legs, trying to bury her teeth in my flesh. With my left hand, I drew my knife and drove the blade down as hard as I could in the back of her skull, right above the collar. The furious tension was instantly gone, and she dropped to the ground. A piece of my pant leg caught between her teeth. Top Sims came from my left and stood cover while I reloaded, dropping a lab tech and a walker by the time I had the new mag in and the slide released. There was a bull roar and we pivoted to see Bunny being rushed by three walkers. There were a half-dozen kids huddled behind him and his shotgun was empty. He slammed the folding stock of the shotgun across the face of one walker and I could tell that he was unnerved when the monster just shook it off. Years of training condition us to fight even the most aggressive person, but none of us had trained to fight the dead. To fight things that could not be hurt, that could barely be stopped. I started in his direction, but Top waved me off. I got it! Bullets burned the air around me, and I turned to see a pair of guards using an overturned table as a shooting blind. Dumbasses. The table was aluminum. I put four rounds through the thin metal, two sets of two, and both men fell back with sucking chest wounds. The blur of movement made me turn again, and a little boy of about seven wrapped his arms around my left thigh and clung to me, screaming, his face streaked with tears. A walker came loping across the floor, red teeth bared in a hungry grimace. I shot him in the chest and head, and then shot a guard. The clinging child let go, and I turned to see him falling to the floor. One side of his face was streaked with blood from a terrible bite. The walker had gotten him before he'd run to me for help. The child's body twitched and thrashed and lay still. God Almighty. Across the room I saw Skip and Ollie moving along the fringes of the room with a line of children between them, killing every adult they encountered. A guard nearly clipped me with a short burst from his AK-47, but I saw the movement of the barrel and beat him to the trigger pull. Behind him I saw that there were still some children in the cage. The door was closed, but unlocked, and the children had fingers hooked through the chicken wire, trying to hold the door closed as six walkers fought to pull it open. Only the walkers' lack of coordination had kept the children safe this long, but inch by inch, the door was opening. I tore across the room. Gunfire made me dodge to the left, and a line of bullets chased me along a lab table, shattering glass and filling the air with a spray of jagged shards. I dodged around a lab tech so that he was chopped apart by the gunfire. A guard was at the end of the table, drawing a bead on Skip. There were too many children around, so I bashed down on his wrist with my gun barrel and chopped him across the throat with my left hand. He pitched back out of my way. I brought the gun up and shot three of the walkers, using two shots for each, concentrating on the ones farthest away from the children. They collapsed down, and then I plowed into the remaining three undead. I used my last two bullets to kill one of them point blank, and as his body sagged, I front-kicked his corpse into the zombie next to him. The two of them crashed down, and I spun to take the last creature standing, a man in jeans and a Hellboy t-shirt. I slammed into his chest with my forearms so that his weight crashed the cage door shut. He lunged his head over my arm and caught the strap of my Kevlar vest in his teeth. I tried boxing his ears with cupped palms, but that did no good. So I grabbed him by the hair and the back of the belt and rammed him headfirst into the wall. His skull collapsed on the first impact. The bones in his neck splintered on the third. I dropped him as the zombie who'd fallen under the one I'd kicked came crawling out from under, scuttling toward me on hands and knees. I axe-kicked the back of his neck and he dropped, twitching for a moment, and then lay still. I put my back to the cage as I switched magazines. My last one. The room was still in turmoil, but now each of my men had set up defensive stations. Top and Bunny had at least 10 kids behind them, and they were standing shoulder to shoulder, taking careful aim to bring down walkers, techs, and guards. Across the room, Skip Tyler had six kids tucked into a niche made from a collapsed table and a line of blue cases. There were bodies heaped in front of him. Ollie was by the entrance, and as the last few guards tried to race past him to escape, he coldly shot them down. In the center of the room there were still half a dozen walkers, a few guards, and some kids. Everyone was covered with blood, and I could see why none of my guys had gone to rescue those children. It was impossible to tell if they were infected or not. I had 12 rounds left, and there were still six kids out there. I had to try. I rushed in, firing as I ran, dropping guards and walkers alike. One of the kids ran toward me, and I knelt down, waving him on even as I aimed past him. But when he was 10 feet away, I saw that his eyes were empty and his mouth was open, teeth bared. It was the little kid who had clung to me for safety. God, I whispered through a throat filled with hot ash. I shot the child. For one moment, there was a lull in the gunfire as the child pitched backward from the point of impact and slid to a stop on the floor. I could feel every set of eyes in the room on me, burning me with their stares. The children huddled behind my men cringed and cried out in renewed terror. Then one of the other children in the center of the room snarled with unnatural hunger and rushed at Skip's group. The gunfire began again. When it stopped, nothing moved in the center of the room except a pall of gun smoke and white fog that was now polluted with red. I stood on the fringes of the carnage, my pistol held out in front of me. One bullet left. The thunder I heard in my ears may have been the echo of the gunfire, or it may have been my own heart pounding out like the drums of damnation. Slowly, filled with fear and horror at what we had all just done, I lowered my gun. Chapter 44. Claymont, Delaware, Tuesday, June 30th, 6:35 p.m. I called it in. There was an overturned table behind me, and I leaned against it while I surveyed the room. A pall of acrid gun smoke hung like a blue veil in the humid air, and the kids kept crying. Each of my men looked stricken, except for Ollie Brown, whose face showed nothing at all. He could give Church a run for his money. Skip looked sick. Bunny's and Top's faces were rigid with fury. I wondered what expression was on my face. Maybe shock, probably fear. But if my features truly reflected what I felt, then my expression would be mingled horror at what had been about to happen to these poor kids, and a dead sickness for what I had just done. That I'd been forced to do it made no difference to me at all. I felt unclean. 5 minutes ago, there had been dozens of people in this room. Now most of them were dead. I'd killed at least a quarter of them myself. I'd killed so many people that I'd lost count. The realization hit my brain like a fist. I'd killed before, but this was worse. 10 times worse than the task force raid. And part of the guilt I felt was a secret shame because deep inside my soul, the warrior part of me was beating his chest and yelling in exultant triumph even while the more civilized parts of me cringed. I took a step toward Top's group, but the children behind him shrieked and pulled back, terrified of me. They'd seen me gun down at least 2 other children. They were too young to understand about the infection. They couldn't know I wasn't a monster, too. Top gathered a few of them in his arms, shushing them, murmuring quiet words as Bunny stood by, awkward and helpless. I stayed where I was. There was a noise, and I looked up to see Alpha Team flooding into the room, weapons up and out. Major Cortland was in front with her pistol in her hands. Gus Dietrich was on her flank. They skidded to a stop and stared at the scene of total carnage.
"Bloody hell,"
gasped Cortland, and her words could not have been more aptly chosen. Dietrich stared open-mouthed, and the agents of Alpha Team looked from the heaps of corpses to the crowds of weeping children to the bloodied members of Echo Team. Cortland recovered first. She keyed her radio.
"Alpha 1 to base. We need full medical teams, double quick. We have multiple civilian victims requiring immediate medical attention and evac."
She paused as she did a quick head count.
"Civilians are all children. Repeat, civilians are children times 17. Send all available medical units."
I pushed off from the table and walked over to her, my eyes stinging from the smoke. She opened her mouth to say something, then caught herself, paused, and finally said,
"Are you all right, Captain?"
I very nearly bit her head off. It was such a stupid and clumsy question, but I buried that reaction. What else could she say? "I'll live," I said. "Tell your people there are 0 infected among the children. All of the bite victims are
I couldn't finish it. She swallowed and relayed the info, then clicked off her mic.
Your men?
No casualties. Cortland nodded, and for a moment we shared a look. Soldier to soldier, or warrior to warrior. The ugly truth was that there were going to be casualties among my men. This event would scar every single one of them. She looked around as the first wave of EMTs spread out through the room. The children shrieked and wept. Some of them ran toward the men and women in uniforms, and the EMTs gathered them up in their arms. Some of the medics and soldiers weeping as they held the kids. Other children shrank back, all trust in adults having been torn out of them. A few sat in unmoving silence, speaking of damage that went all the way down to the cellar of their souls. "Was this how it was at St. Michael's?" I asked. She shook her head.
"No. Everyone there died. My team was outside the whole time."
I nodded.
"This morning I was just a cop," I said.
"I know."
There was more to say, but it didn't need to be said aloud. We both understood. "We got a live one," Dietrich called, and we turned to see a wounded lab tech trying to crawl out from under a dead walker. In his nearly mindless state of pain, he reached out to the nearest person in a soundless plea for help. Ollie Brown stood over him, a sneer of contempt on his face. He drew his pistol and racked the slide. "Stand down!" I bellowed, starting forward, but Brown was already bringing the barrel down toward the tech. Suddenly Gus Dietrich stepped forward, grabbed Ollie's wrist, and swung it violently upward. The pistol blast was shockingly loud, even to my wounded ears, but the bullet just buried itself in the wooden roof timbers 30 feet above. I got up in Ollie's face. "Stand down right now, Lieutenant." His face was ugly with fury, but after a long moment the tension bled out of his limbs. Top Sims stepped between him and the lab tech, his hand on his holstered pistol. "Let him go, Sergeant," I said, and Dietrich carefully released Ollie's wrist and took a short step to one side, his eyes hard. To Ollie I said, "Secure your weapon." Ollie's eyes bored into mine and then passed me to the tech, and for a second I thought he was going to try for the shot. But then he eased the hammer down, flicked on the safety, and holstered his piece. EMTs immediately stepped up to triage the wounded man. "What the hell's wrong with you?" I snapped. "What part of the mission orders sound like shoot unarmed prisoners?" "He's a piece of shit," Ollie sneered. "He's the only person we have left to interrogate." Ollie said nothing, so I grabbed him by the elbow and pulled him a few yards away. I wasn't nice about it, and when he tried to pull his arm away, I dug into a nerve. Even with his stone face, the pain showed through. I eased the pressure, and he jerked his arm free. "Okay, Ollie, let's sort this out right here, right now."
"There's nothing to sort out," he said, then added a sarcastic,
"Sir, you're one more smart-ass remark away from getting bounced off this team." He blinked at that and snapped his mouth shut on whatever he was about to say next. I leaned close. "You're a top-notch fighter, Ollie, and I'd rather keep you than lose you, but if you can't follow orders, then you are no good to me or anyone. Now I'm going to ask you only once, and that's it. Are you on my team or not?" Ollie met my stare for a long 10 count. Then he inhaled sharply through his nose and exhaled slowly. "Fuck it," he said. I waited. "I'm in. My rules, my way." He nodded and closed his eyes for a few seconds. "Yes, sir." No sarcasm this time. "Look at me," I said. He opened his eyes. "Say it again."
"Yes, sir. Your rules, your way."
I nodded and stepped back. "Then we won't discuss this again." I turned and walked away, passing Dietrich and Cortland without comment, and rejoined Echo Team. After a moment, Ollie followed. To the team I said, "I guess they'll debrief us once we're back in Baltimore. They'll need to know everything." I paused.
I have a friend, Dr. Rudy Sanchez. He's a police psychiatrist, and he's a good man.
A shrink? Skip asked.
Yeah. He's at the DMS, and I want each of you, each of us, to take a few minutes and sit down with him.
Why?
Asked Skip.
Top turned to him. Tell me something, kid. When you woke up this morning, did you think that by supper time you'd be killing zombies and gunning down little kids?
Skip dropped his eyes and looked dejectedly down at the floor. Top laid a big hand on his shoulder, gave it a squeeze.
Believe me, Skip, you don't want to go to sleep tonight with this in your head and no one to talk to.
Ollie just stood there with his eyes glistening and his fists balled into knots. Bunny said,
I ain't ever gonna sleep again.
Chapter 45. The DMS Warehouse, Baltimore, Tuesday, June 30th, 8:51 p.m. A chopper took us back to the warehouse in Baltimore. On the way, Grace told us that quarters had been set aside for each of us.
It's not much, she said over the whine of the rotor. We had small offices converted into bedrooms. Mr. Church has asked that you and your men go to your quarters and wait until called for. He doesn't want any of you talking to other DMS personnel until he's had a chance to meet with you himself. Don't worry, you're not under suspicion. It's just that a lot of the DMS staff are new, and some have not been informed about the nature of this crisis. Security is paramount.
We didn't like it, but we all understood, and we flew the rest of the way in silence.
I noticed the top was pretending to sleep, but was actually studying Ollie, who had turned stiffly away from Cortland and me and was staring out the window. When Top noticed me watching him, he smiled and closed his eyes. After that, he really did look like he was sleeping, but I didn't believe it. It was nearly dark when we landed. A guard met me as I debarked and took me to Church's office. His face showed little emotion, and he sure as hell didn't rush up to embrace me, but I could see his eyes behind the tinted lenses of his glasses as he gave me a thorough up-and-down appraisal. He waved me to a chair and then sat down behind his desk, and the guard poured me a cup of coffee before he left.
Grace said that there were no injuries sustained by Echo Team.
I almost said nothing that will show, but it was trite. He seemed to guess my thought, though, and nodded.
And you managed to secure a prisoner.
I said nothing.
If he knew about Ollie, and I'm sure he did, he left it off the table.
What's going to happen with those kids?
I don't know. They've all been admitted to the hospital with FBI protection. The Bureau's taken over the problem of identifying them. Some of the children are too traumatized to even give their names. None of them remember how they were taken. A few had recent burns on their skin, consistent with liquid tasers, so we can assume they were taken unawares, perhaps randomly.
Experimenting on kids puts a whole new spin on this thing.
Yes, he said, it does. And I want to hear your full report on what happened today, Captain. But first, I want your assessment of the crab plant. When is the absolute soonest you can hit it?
There's maybe a slim chance that the hostiles in the other plant won't know about the hit we just did. The cell lines were jammed, right? And you cut the landlines, right?
It's late in the day, I said. Communication between the cells would necessarily be at a minimum anyway. I think we have to hit it by noon tomorrow.
Why not right now? We have sufficient firepower to do a hard entry. I shook my head.
There are three reasons why that's not going to happen tonight. First, you need to interrogate your prisoner. Second, the meat plant was full of kids. Who the hell knows how many civilians are in the crab plant? If you go in all John Wayne, then you could get a lot of innocent people killed.
And the third reason?
Because that plant belongs to Echo Team, and I don't want anyone else jumping our action. Look, you hired us on to be your first team. Well, you got what you paid for. I know you had to be here watching the feeds from the helmet cams, so you know what we went through in there, and you know how tight my guys are. Alpha Team may be DMS Elite or some shit, but they were a half step off getting to first base. They should have been in there faster. I shouldn't have had to call them once things got hot. Grace Cortland and Gus Dietrich are superb agents, as good as anyone on Echo Team, Church said. At one point, all of them were. But since St. Michael's, they've been showing signs of stress disorder. In the last 2 days, their team drills are down by 14%, and their live ammunition drills show hesitation. None of that was there before St. Michael's. Now I understood. I put my cup down and leaned my elbows on his desk.
So we understand each other here?
If what you saw in Delaware has taught us anything, it's that we are losing ground on this thing. I want the crab plant hit tonight, now. No way! My team needs to rest. You talk about reduction in combat efficiency? Well, you put a top team into a critical situation without time to rest, then you don't have a top team anymore. You have tired men who will be off their game. Going right back out would get them killed. 12 hours to sleep and plan the hit. 2 hours sleep and they debrief in the helo. After a minute, I said, I see the science team. Then we go in 3 hours. That's not negotiable. I won't lead my team to a slaughter. I'll go in alone before I do that. For a moment, it looked like he was considering that as a suggestion. Then he nodded. Okay. He took a vanilla wafer and gestured to the plate. Have one. I had an Oreo. Do you want reconnaissance or scorched earth? My science division needs data. Computers, lab equipment, pathogen samples, we need to leave the place intact. What kind of backup can we expect? The works. Alpha Team will be on deck, and they'll be first in if you need them. F-18s in the air, helo support for extraction if it gets hot. Special Forces strike teams can be inside in 10 minutes. And the National Guard is on standby. If it turns into a firefight, we have the edge. If the perimeter is breached, we'll take a closer look at the scorched earth option. He didn't have to explain that if there was a containment breach and my team was inside, then we'd be flash fried along with the hostiles. And even though that's what I would order myself, it didn't make me feel any better about it.
What's going on with the prisoner? I thought you'd be interrogating him by now.
That would be nice, he agreed. But he has 2 bullets in his chest cavity. He's in surgery. They'll page me the moment he's stabilized enough to answer questions.
And what if the control disease kicks in before then?
Then there will be that much more pressure on you to bring me another prisoner when you hit the crab plant.
Swell, I finished my coffee. Okay, take me to your mad scientists.
Chapter 46. The DMS Warehouse, Baltimore, Tuesday, June 30th, 9:20 p.m. As he led me to the labs, Church said,
Dr. Sanchez has agreed, conditionally, to help us through the current crisis.
What are his conditions?
He'll be here as long as you are. Apparently he thinks you need a minder.
He appeared amused.
Major Cortland is bringing him up to speed on everything.
Rudy's not a fighter.
We all serve according to our nature, Captain. Besides, your friend may be tougher than you know.
I didn't say he wasn't tough. I just don't want to see you put a gun in his hand.
Noted.
We entered a huge loading dock that had been newly enclosed by cinderblock, and the smell of limestone and concrete hung thick in the damp air. There was a row of oversized trailer homes of the kind used as temporary offices on construction sites. As we passed each, Church threw out a single identifying word. Cryptography. Surveillance. Operations. Computers. We passed one whose door was marked with a 12 in black block letters, and Church made no comment about this one. There were 4 armed guards outside, 2 facing out, 2 facing the unit's only door, and a tripod-mounted 50 stood behind a half-circle of sandbags, its wicked black mouth pointing at the trailer door. I slowed for a moment, frowning, feeling the tension that was screaming in the air, and I felt a chill like an icy hand close around the back of my neck.
Damn, I breathed. You have more of them in there?
Among other things, yes, he said softly.
It's also our surgical suite, and that's where our prisoner is. But to answer your question, we have a total of 6.
Like Javad?
Church's face seemed to harden as he said.
The 6 walkers were all from St. Michael's. 1 doctor, 3 civilians, 2 DMS agents.
My God.
This evening I'm having 3 of them sent to our Brooklyn facility for study. The others will remain here.
For study? But you're talking about your own people.
They're dead, Captain.
Church,
they're dead.
Chapter 47. Hotel Ishtar, Baghdad, June 30th.
Who was on the phone?
Galt asked as he came out of the bathroom, a plush crimson robe cinched around him.
Was it Amira?
Toys handed him a cup of coffee on a china saucer.
No, it was the Yank again.
What did he want? No, let me guess, the Americans finally raided the crab plant, bloody well timed, too.
No, said Toys. It seems they've raided the other facility, the one in Delaware, the meat-packing plant.
He overpronounced the word meat-packing, enjoying the implications of each syllable.
Galt gave a bemused grunt and sipped his coffee. That's unfortunate.
He sat and chewed his lip for a few seconds.
What about the other plant? They were supposed to locate and infiltrate that first.
Toys sniffed. Leave it to the U.S. government to always do the right thing at the wrong time. What's the phrase you like so much?
Bass ackwards.
Toys giggled. He loved to make Galt say it.
Galt finished his coffee and held his cup out for more. Toys refilled it, and they sat down.
Galt in the overstuffed chair by the French windows, Toys perched on the edge of the couch with his saucer on his knees. An iPod in a Bose speaker dock played Andy Williams singing Steve Allen with Alvy West on alto sax. Meet me where they play the blues. Toys had been converting all of Galt's vast collection of historic big band music to the iPod. Galt wondered where he found the time.
When the song ended, Toys said, This alteration in the timetable, is that going to change things? With El Musclehead, I mean.
I've been working that through in my head. The timing is tricky. It really would have been better if they'd hit the crab plant first, and I can't understand why they didn't.
Could they have decrypted the files from the warehouse? You said it was only a matter of time.
A matter of very precise time. I paid good money to make sure that those files would not be cracked this quickly. The flash drive was deliberately and very precisely damaged, and the programs corrupted just enough to have given us at least 40 hours more, even if they used the best equipment.
He shook his head in frustration.
Dr. Renson and that other computer geek assured me that no technology exists to do it faster.
What about mind reader?
Galt waved that away.
Mind reader's a myth. It's internet folklore cooked up in some hacker's fantasies. They've been mythologizing about it since the 90s.
Toys was insistent. What if it's real?
Galt shrugged.
If it's real and the DMS has it, then yes, they could scramble the timetable, but so what? At this point, nothing they do can stop the program.
You're the boss, Toys said in a wounded tone of voice that he knew needled Galt. But it doesn't answer the question of what to do about the crab plant, and whether this will spoil the whole operation.
No, Galt said after some consideration. No, it won't spoil the plan. Too many things are in motion now, but as far as the plant goes, it won't be a total disaster.
Toys studied his face and began to grin. You're making that face. I know that face. What have you got cooking over there?
Galt gave him an enigmatic smile.
Expect another call from the Yank sometime soon.
Purred Toys. I'll be waiting with bated breath.
Chapter 48.
The DMS Warehouse, Baltimore, Tuesday, June 30th, 9:24 p.m. The interior of the lab was somewhere between a scientist's wet dream and a god-awful mess, with heaps of books and spilled stacks of computer printouts, coffee cups everywhere, and tables laden with every manner of diagnostic and forensics equipment. Gas chromatographs, portable DNA sequencers, and a lot of stuff I'd never seen before, even at the state crime lab, sci-fi stuff. Machines pinged and beeped and blipped, and a dozen technicians in white lab coats pushed buttons and made notes on clipboards and exchanged grim looks. In the middle of all of this was one desk bigger than all the others that was a shrine to pop culture geekiness, and though I pride myself on seldom showing surprise, I went a little slack-jawed at what I saw. In an astonishing display of either the blackest humor on record or spectacular bad taste, there were horror magazines, bobbleheads of zombies from half a dozen movies, at least 50 zombie novels with dog-eared pages, and the entire collection of resin action figures of Marvel superheroes as decaying zombies. Seated like a happy school kid in the middle of this oasis of poor taste was a sloppy 30-something Chinese guy with a bad haircut and a Hawaiian shirt under his lab coat. Church stood beside the desk, but not too close, and his immaculate suit and air of command seemed like a statement by comparison. "Captain," Church said, "let me introduce Dr. Who." I stared. "Doctor Who? Are you shitting me? This some kind of goofy code name or something?" "H-U," Church said, spelling it. "Oh." Without rising, Who offered his hand and I shook it. I expected something slack and moist, but he broke the stereotype and gave me a hard, dry shake. What he said, though, was, "You're the hot-shot zombie killer, man. I just saw the footage from Delaware. Wow! Freaking awesome! You can kick zombie ass!" He smelled like old baked bread, which is not as good as it sounds. "I thought you guys called them walkers." "Yeah, sometimes," he shrugged. "It's more PC, I guess. Doesn't stress the troops." I gave his toys a significant nod. "And you wouldn't want to appear insensitive." Who grinned. "Denial is stupid. We're fighting the living dead. Would you prefer we call them undead citizens? I mean, I originally wanted to call them ALFs." I looked from him to Church. "Alien lifeless forms," Church said with a wooden face. "Get it?" Who said. "Because they're illegal aliens." I said, "How do people not shoot you?" He spread his hands. "I'm useful." And I swear to God, I saw Church's mouth silently form the words, "only just." Aloud, he said, "Doctor Who enjoys his jokes more than does his audience." "You said as much about me the first time we met." Church turned to the scientist. "Please answer any questions Captain Ledger has."
"What's his clearance level?"
Church was looking at me as he said,
"Open door. He's in the family now."
With that, he walked over to a nearby workstation, pulled out the chair, sat, crossed his legs, and appeared to totally tune us out. Who looked me up and down for a moment, nodding to himself, then he beamed a great smile. "You have any background in science?"
"Forensics on the job," I said.
"A few related night courses, and a subscription to Popular Science." "I'll use smallish words," he said, trying not to sound as condescending as he was.
"We're dealing with a weaponized disease of immense complexity. This didn't evolve. This isn't Mother Nature getting cranky and throwing out a mutation. This isn't even a disease pathogen that could have evolved. We're into the bizarro zone here. Somebody brewed this up in a lab, and whoever made this is smart."
"Joe Obvious speaks," I said.
"No," he said. "I mean scary smart. Whoever did this should have a shelf full of Nobel Prizes and a whole alphabet soup behind his name. I don't have the stuff to make this. Mr. Church buys me lots of nice toys. This would take a major research facility,
Electron mics, clean rooms, and a lot of shit you never heard of, maybe. Maybe stuff no one's ever heard of. This is radical technology, Captain. Call me Joe. Joe? He snapped his fingers. Hey, your name's Joe Ledger. Yeah, I thought we'd pretty well established that. You into comic books? You know, Dr. Spectrum? He had an expectant look on his face. Dr. Spectrum, the superhero from Marvel Comics. His secret identity is Joe Ledger. That's pretty cool, don't you think? All things considered, I said. No, not very much. Doctor, Church said with a note of soft warning in his voice. Okay, whatever, we're talking about the disease, he said, and for a moment I saw the scientist behind the geek facade. Look, science is only occasionally cool and a soul-crushing bore the other 99% of the time. Aside from the fact that the empirical process requires endless repetition on each and every freaking step, there's also the reality of state and federal regulations on what we can and cannot do. A lot of research opportunities are limited and some are blocked. Biological weapons, that sort of thing. Even with the military? Yes. Even super secret military? I said, half smiling. He hesitated. Well, okay, that starts getting to be a bit more fun, but even then you can't publish half the time, which means you don't get prizes and you don't write bestsellers. No groupies? You joke, but there are women attracted to brains. We don't all die virgins. Okay, and this relates to zombies. How? I think we have ourselves a genuine mad scientist. A supervillain. He seemed really happy about the idea. I kind of wanted to punch him. I glanced at Church, who raised his eyebrows in a you're-the-one-who-wanted-to-talk-to-him kind of look. Who said, I'm serious. We have someone with deep intellect and vast resources. I mean that. Vast. Bear in mind that lots of terrorists come from oil-producing nations. It would take that kind of money for our Dr. Evil to do this sort of thing. Got it. So has your supervillain actually managed to raise the dead? No, look. These walkers are not actually dead, but they're not alive either. I thought those were pretty much the only two choices. Times change. You know that movie Night of the Living Dead? Well, I think Living Dead is a pretty good name for what we got here. He took a slinky off his desk and let it flow back and forth between his palms. Here's the thing. The body is designed by evolution to have natural redundancies without which we'd never survive injury or illness. For example, you only need about 10% function of the liver, 20% function of one kidney, part of one lung. You can live with both arms and legs removed. There are millions of pages of research and case evaluation of patients who have continued to live well past the point where their body should have shut down. In some cases, we can discover why. In some cases, we're still in the dark. With me so far? Sure. Now, look at the walkers. If they were truly and completely dead, then we wouldn't be having this conversation. I'd still be in Brooklyn and you'd be doing whatever you were doing before Mr. Church shanghaied you. Why? Because the dead are dead. They have zero brain function. They don't get up and chase people. Javad Mustafa was dead, I pointed out. I killed him. Twice. Who shook his head? No. You killed him once, and that was during your second encounter with him. Mind you, when you shot him during that raid, you gave him what should have been mortal wounds, and he would have died had it not been for the presence of this pathogen. But this little bastard of a disease did not allow Javad to die. You see, this disease shuts down any part of the body that is not directly related to the purpose of its existence.
Which is?
To spread the disease. These things are designed to be vectors.
Very aggressive vectors.
The disease simply shut off the areas damaged by your bullets. Don't look at me like that. I know how weird this sounds. But someone cooked up something that nearly kills its victims, but at the same time prevents them from dying as we previously understood death. Plus, they added a little of this and a little of that so that
The host body, the walker, aggressively spreads the pathogen. It's marvelous, but it's bizarre, because the disease is constantly trying to kill the host while working like a bastard to keep parts of it alive.
That doesn't make sense.
Sure it does, but not in the way you think. And to a degree, that does fit with nature. Sort of. When you have an infection, the fever you get is the immune system's attempt to burn it out of the bloodstream. Sometimes the fever does more harm than the disease. Psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis. There are a couple of examples of the immune system doing harm because it's trying to fix the wrong problem, or trying too hard to fix a minor problem. In nature, there are plenty of examples, he said. But what we have here is someone who has taken that concept into a totally new direction. We have a fatal disease, several parasites, gene therapy, plus some other shit we haven't sorted out yet, all present in a molecular cluster unlike anything on record. If these guys weren't trying to destroy America, they could make billions off the patents alone.
Does this have anything to do with fatal familial insomnia? He raised his eyebrows. Bonus points for even knowing that name. The answer to that is yes and no. That's the prion disease they used as a starter kit, but they've tricked it out with the other stuff. Even now, it has some of the characteristics of a typical TSE.
TSE? Prions are neurodegenerative diseases called transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, or TSEs, he explained. We still know very little about prion transmission and their pathogenesis. We do know that prions are proteins that have become folded and in that form act differently from normal proteins. These are strange little bastards. They have no DNA and yet they're capable of self-replication. Usually sporadic cases strike about one person per million. And at the moment these account for, say, about 85% of all TSE cases. Then you have familial cases, which account for 10% of TSEs, and which are passed down through bloodlines in ways not yet understood, since inherited traits are genetic, and like I said, prions have no DNA. The remaining 5% are iatrogenic cases, which result from the accidental transmission of the causative agent via contaminated surgical equipment or sometimes you see it occurring as a result of cornea or dura mater transplants, or in the administration of human-derived pituitary growth hormones. Still with me? Clinging on by my fingernails, how come these prions are making monsters instead of just killing people? It's a design requirement of this new disease cluster. Prions produce a lethal decline of cognitive and motor function, and that allows the parasite-driven aggression to cruise past conscious control. Somebody took the prion and attached it to these parasites. Don't even ask how because we don't know yet. It'll be a new process, something they invented. They essentially turned a TSE into a fast-acting serum transfer pathogen, but with all sorts of extras, most notably aggression. The victim's aggression is amped up in such a way as to closely imitate the rage response some PCP and meth addicts have on the downside of a strong high. Ever see the movie 28 Days Later? No? You should. The sequel rocks, too. Anyway, that movie dealt with a virus that stimulated the rage centers in the brain to the point that it was so dominant that all other brain functions were blocked out. The victims existed in total, unending, and ultimately unthinking rage. Very close to what we have here.
What, you think a terrorist with a PhD in chemistry watched a sci-fi flick and thought, hey, that's a good way to kill Americans?
Who shrugged? After all the stuff I've seen in the last week, I wouldn't be surprised. Now, there may be some higher brain functions, but if so, it would be far lower than the most advanced Alzheimer's patient.
An Alzheimer's patient is still going to feel pain. And I beat the shit out of Javad, and he didn't so much as blink.
Yeah, well, we're getting into one of our many gray areas. Remember that we're not dealing with a natural mutation, so a lot of what we know will be based on field observation and clinical testing.
So, if we're talking disease, why are we also talking living dead? How does that work?
That's something we're working on with the walkers we harvested from St. Michael's, Hu said. And for the moment, there was no fanboy smirk on his face.
This disease